Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today again by Harriet Clarford. How are you doing, Harriet?
I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, you're at AIM 100 star this year.
Oh, thanks.
No, you are. It's a compliment.
Thank you.
Take it. And Mark Robinson. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm here.
You're not our A100. You've written... I asked you earlier what you've done for the A100.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing whatsoever.
Nothing.
I've moved on.
Thanks, man.
I'm moving on to the blue chips. I'm never going back.
Well, not quite, because you've got a couple of results this week in the AIM space.
I do.
Which didn't quite make it, but no. We'll talk about those in a minute. And ponder the question whether they might make it in the months ahead. Okay, let's start, though, with the news, because... quite a lot going on this week. And I guess the big story of the week is Capita.
Yes. It's a big story this week. Well, it's a big story this month, really. The early part of this year, mainly because of the collapse of Carillion and the lingering doubts over the systemic danger to that particular sector.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the big news here, I mean, we have actually looked at the outsourcers since the collapse of Carillion and kind of asked the question, could anyone else suffer the same terrible fate? But Capita may not face the same terrible fate because it has raised some money this week, or is in the process of raising some money.
Yes, and I don't think it has quite the same working capital commitments as a proportion of their cash flows that Carillion did. There's other reasons why it's seen as a safer bet. And plus, there's the obvious political angle now as well, because the government would be absolutely horrified to think that it would go the same way. So they'd be pulling out all stops to make sure that those legacy contracts are viable.
Capita, from some of the commentary I've seen this week, you know, is essentially in some instances pretty much the running the entirety of some councils.
Yeah, exactly. It was. It's been very successful in the bidding process down through the years. However, as the article points out, you know, this in itself is no guarantee of success, because the bidding process, the broader issue of bidding process into PFI initiatives and other sort of state private enterprises, is that it could well be fundamentally flawed, disadvantageous to the people that are actually pitching the bids, because it ends up being a bit of a low-ball affair. It's a point that Algie Hall makes along with the piece.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, there were some terrifying stats on actually the real cost of PFI to the taxpayer.
Yeah, those figures came out fairly recently from the National Audit Office, and, you know, perhaps the most... the spookiest ones relate to the health service and schools, where PFI initiatives, it's usually a lease-back operation in many cases with health facilities throughout the country. But the figures from the National Audit Office say it would have been substantially cheaper in most cases if the government had just gone ahead with the conventional capital raising within the public service and built the hospitals themselves. It's just that it was, I guess, it's really difficult to know why government went on all this long.
Keeping debt off the balance sheet?
I mean, it's just short-termism writ large. But this has been going on, don't forget, since John Major's government as well.
Although they didn't really go hell for leather down the PFI route. I think there were maybe one or two PFI-style contracts under the Conservative government before 1997.
Yes, it was Tony Blair and the Labour government that made this something of an art form as well. And it's taken a while. Well, actually, there's doubts right along, but they were, again, on ideological grounds.
I remember a big series in Private Eye, actually, looking at PFI and ripping it to shreds.
Yes, of course.
We've known this for a long time.
Indeed. I mean, all the criticisms couldn't have all been off beam or motivated purely by politics. But we've reached a stage now with Carillion that I think the public is really starting to sit up and take notice nowadays. So what does this say for Capita? It means going forward that the bidding process will become possibly more stringent in a sense.
Well, stringent in respect of they will have to actually... quotes the real cost of delivering these when they pitch for the business.
Well, this is it. This is it. There'll be no alternatives other than to do that. And in many cases, a lot of the outsourcing companies are actually paring back their enterprises as well.
One question I would have, I mean, given we're talking about PFI, which is slightly different from the kind of sort of day-to-day running of government services, which companies like Capita are very heavily invested in. If it's so profitable, why do they need to raise money now?
Well, the point is, it hasn't been that profitable.
PFI might have been, but we're talking about two different things here. So the running of day-to-day services is much more difficult and expensive than they perhaps bid for.
Well, exactly. And plus, it's done independently within the group structure of these organisations as well. And when you've got framework contracts as well, this is another area where outsourcers are providing services at a municipal level. These framework agreements or contracts are a kind of a number written on the back of a fag packet, really, when they begin these contracts. And of course, they have no real idea of the fixed asset expenses going forward. And so I've lost track of the number of legacy contracts I've looked at where this has gone, you know, frightfully wrong for the company.
Well, the same thing happened to BT not that long ago. You know, Global Services was essentially bidding for contracts and couldn't make money on them because it underbid.
Yeah.
Because the future is very difficult to predict. And there's no mechanism in the contracts for actually renegotiating along the way.
Well, the point is as well, when these organisations grow, and they grew very quickly on the back of the government granting these type of public-private partnerships, if you like, by very definition, it would have been impossible for management to keep a handle on every part of that business, every contract. This has crossed across multiple government agencies and devolved institutions as well. And just the sheer complexity of the resultant operations make it almost impossible to keep a... I mean, who would be a CFO for a company like Capita?
It will indeed. Okay, so the billion-dollar question, in fact, a £1 billion question, because that is all Capita is worth now. It was worth a lot more than that in days of yore, are these shares now worth buying given the capital injection? The shares have climbed quite steeply this week, up by a fifth. Are we convinced that this is the nadir?
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. I think we've got Capita on a seller at the moment. But I guess even though if they're making the right noises, even if government's making the right noises, even if going forward this whole process will become more viable economically, you've just got to look at the balance sheet and just have a look at the... have a look at the intangible assets there, and actually changes to accounting standards as well, which will lead to greater provisions, or which could lead to greater provisions on
this
intangible assets.
IFRS 15.
And IFRS
15.
Yep. You just have to look at that, and like their intangibles account for the lion's share of non-current assets at the moment as well, about 70%. And that was very much the case with Carillion too. In of itself, that doesn't mean that it just makes the company far more vulnerable.
It's a very difficult turnaround, I think, is the short answer.
Yes, indeed. We really have to keep an eye on this as well, because when things start to go bad on the balance sheet, they turn bad very quickly. It's a bit like Ernest Hemingway say, "How does someone go broke?" It's slowly, 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 then very quickly, you know.
Mm. Which is exactly what happened to Carillion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one to keep an eye on. It's not a sector I'm a big fan of, and we're not a fan of generally on the magazine. Okay, let's talk about... Thank you, Mark. Let's talk about Fidessa, which is the other big story in the news section. One of the other big stories in the news section this week. This is an amazing takeover battle that's raging here.
Yeah, well, the battle may now be over. Just to recap, I suppose, back on the 21st of February, Fidessa received this exciting 1.4 billion cash offer from a Swiss company called Temenos. So Fidessa is a trading software company and Temenos is a Swiss banking software company. And I think, you know, investors are excited. It seemed like there are a lot of synergies between the two companies. And Fidessa's board recommended the bid over 2 months ago now. A couple of months almost passed, and as I said, it looked relatively straightforward. And then at the last minute, just before the shareholder vote to approve Temenos's bid, two other potential bidders came forward, and they were identified as a US company called SS&C and another company called Ion Investment Group.
It's like eBay, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It did slightly remind me of my online shopping.
You want to buy something on eBay, you don't put your bid in early. Yeah. You wait until the 20 seconds before the thing closes.
Yeah, it was very much at the 11th hour. And so Fidessa decided, obviously, to delay the shareholder vote on the Temenos bid while those two bidders had time to firm up their potential offers. And again, kind of waiting until the 11th hour, Ion, on the 20th of April, just before the 5 p.m. deadline issued by the takeover panel, put in a cash offer of $1.5 billion, so trumped Temenos's offer. And kind of understandably, Fidessa switched its recommendation from Temenos to Ion. And I think, you know, the financial appeal of Ion's offer is clear. It's an 8.5% premium to Temenos's offer. I think
that would do the trick.
Yes, exactly. And I think shareholders would receive around £38.703, as well as a dividend of around 79.7p. So you can see why investors were excited. Although the shares at the time actually only moved up by just under a percentage point. I mean, maybe that slight move was because investors were hoping for an even better offer to emerge from Temenos. It wasn't immediately clear. And then
it's funny, actually, just on the subject of Temenos, that they have actually gone fishing in the UK market before and walked away.
Yeah.
From deals. Mysis had a big banking software division that Temenos looked at a few years back, and they walked away
right.
in the end.
Well, they actually ultimately did a similar thing here. They decided right after market close that day that the Ion offer came out, Temenos's chairman said, actually, we're not going to revise our offer. It's not in the interest of our own shareholders. And I think he said, you know, we're the leader in a winner-takes-all market, and sort of backed off. And I think they've agreed to let the terms of their offer lapse. I think the meeting had been adjourned to the 27th of April. And then we learned earlier this week that SS&C also isn't going to make an offer. So it looks like Ion's offer is going to win, unless there are any more surprises. I think shareholders will probably receive a prospectus quite soon. I don't believe a date's been set, but... yeah, it's amazing to see how much interest there is in this UK software company.
It's a good company. I mean, it provides essentially platforms for the city, dealers, traders, etc.
Exactly. I think right now that is something that's very much in demand, particularly with an intensifying regulatory environment with MiFID II.
Yeah.
You know, people need to be more clear and transparent about the way they report and they trade. So
it's
exciting,
fascinating stuff. And it's not the only takeover that's happening at the moment. So about a day before we went to press, City Fibre International, which is a broadband infrastructure company, received a bid as well.
Yeah. So City Fibre received a bid at a 93% premium to its share price the day before. I think shareholders would receive 81p each per share, and so the bid values City Fibre, I think, £538 million. Obviously quite a different sum from Fidessa, but they are very different companies.
It's a great chart.
Yeah.
I must admit, I usually do the charts a day early, and I updated this one because it's quite spectacular. That said, City Fibre's share price had been falling over the course of the year.
It had. And I think, you know, laying fibre cables is an expensive business, and City Fibre last July, I think, had to tap shareholders for £200 million. And, you know, its prospects are exciting. It could be a rival to BT's Openreach business. But what it really needed was money. And excitingly, it has received this offer from a Goldman Sachs-backed fund and another company called Antin Infrastructure Partners. And I think Megan, who's our kind of expert on fibre, thinks that this could be a really exciting deal for it.
Yeah.
And I think longer-term analysts have suggested that, you know, this might not be a lifetime solution for City Fibre, and it may ultimately be acquired by a telecoms company which isn't necessarily looking to lay the fibres itself.
I guess one of the big questions would be, I mean, given what's happened at Fidessa, and I don't necessarily expect you to answer this right now, Harry, but, you know, what the Fidessa thing has given us perhaps a lesson to learn from is that sometimes it's good to wait. Don't accept the deal. Mm. Hang on. See what you know, if other bidders are flushed out of the woodwork. And, you know, is it possible that another bidder could come along here? I mean, it's, you know, infrastructure, and especially broadband infrastructure, is an exciting space.
I mean, it might happen, but I just think the premium is so high. You know, a 93% premium, just it seems unlikely that would be trumped, but it could happen. You know, we, as you said, we saw these two surprises for Fidesa. I'm not sure if a fiber infrastructure company is so much in demand as a trading software company, but it could be.
Absolutely. And of course, we've had another merger situation this week with the Takeda Shire deal, which is finally looking like it's going to happen. Yep. Again, the second time that Shire's been approached. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, the UK companies are in demand.
Yeah, that's good news.
Yeah, yeah. And shareholders will walk away, hopefully, with a nice premium. But fewer companies to invest in.
Yeah, well, this is true. But the Shire reaction was pretty lukewarm, I thought. I mean, I'm not sure if that will... they're probably actually trying to flush out another offer as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I must admit, I think the problem there is that people are actually worried about whether Takeda has the firepower to actually buy this thing. But but there you go.
It's a part scrip offer as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so not always as popular as a cash offer. But there is another interesting story which we've covered in the news section, which is not so much a merger, but a demerger. Now, these things, I like demergers. They create value, and this is an interesting one, which I know you looked at this week, Robbo.
Yeah, well, actually, Tom Dines covered it, and it was it came as no surprise, really. I mean, it's been the news has been around for a while, but Whitbread are effectively separating their Costa coffee chain from Premier Inn and some of their other brands as well. This is a result of pressure from activist investors. I think Elliott Advisors was the latest.
Elliott's Advisors.
Who today, I think, have bought Waterstones Bookshop.
I think you're right, yeah, absolutely. They have indeed.
So, yeah. You know a little bit more about the company than I do.
Well, Whitbread.
Whitbread itself. But,
I know about coffee and hotels.
Well, Costa, it's not a bad time in a sense, really, because both divisions, if you like, Costa and Premier, are developing their overseas markets, so committing quite a lot of investment capital. I think it's Premier Inn and trying to fill that medium business space in Germany, I believe.
Costa, I think, went into Poland a few years back.
They have been in Poland, but they're looking at China now.
And, okay.
Yeah, and they haven't performed that well in the domestic market this year. But then again, that's a pretty crowded space on the UK high street.
Also, consumer spending is generally a little bit softer than...
Yes, but, you know, this comes down to the elasticity of demand for coffee, which actually, that's a separate issue altogether. But... I mean, they haven't performed that well, and they're looking at, I'm told that they're looking at rejigging their model in the UK as well to get through more drive-through outlets, which seems rather a strange thing to me.
Do you think so? Honestly, I kind of make sense. I occasionally go back, my petrol station that I use is right next to a McDonald's. And the queues for that drive-through are always huge.
Oh, yes. I mean, I have no doubt that it's commercially successful.
And Costa, I mean, you know, walk down the high street on a Sunday, and it's always packed. I don't get it, but there you go. Yeah. People like it.
Well, exactly. Exactly. But you said yourself that there's a record there with demergers as well. They can create value for shareholders. Existing shareholders will end up with equity in both these companies as well. And the thinking behind it, of course, where they've got these capital programs in train at the moment, it'll allow management to focus more fully on the development there. And so I can, obviously the Whitbread model isn't quite as complex as Capita, but it still has its benefits there.
As I said, I like demergers. You know, you look back over the years, to go back to the whole British Gas privatisation, for example, you ended up with three companies there, you know, and all pretty much over the years they all did quite well, particularly say BG over many years. National Grid has done extremely well. Centrica, not.
But, true. Tom's pretty keen on the idea.
I like the idea too. I think the merger is good. Fair play to Alison Britton, chief executive there, because it could have been a protract. I mean, it has sort of dragged on for a while, but you know, sometimes chief execs on pride alone, try and front up to these activists. And I think fair play.
Plus the overall business is. Could probably do because they've managed to sort of increase their cost reduction targets. They seem to be working on efficiencies even prior to this deal as well, which will help facilitate it too.
Yeah, I think it's good. Let's stick with the results section. And as I alluded to earlier in the podcast, a couple of results that you've written this week, Robbo, from the AIM space, but which haven't for some reason, found their way yet into the AIM-100. Or they might have done, we couldn't remember, where they had been there and dropped out, or they hadn't quite made it there. So we start with one that I know was there last year, which was Xeros. And this is the washing machine company.
Yes, they make these patent polymer beads and systems that go on commercial washing machines, and also they're used within the tannery industry as well.
So the principle is that, and I guess the key technology there is that it uses less water.
It uses much less water, less detergent, because you still use a certain amount of commercial detergent, but only a minuscule amount compared to conventional means. Uses less juice as a result of it as well. Uses less power. Now, this has been proven in a number of academic tests, and plus it's been the technology has been in use primarily in the United States. The company is in discussions with several OEMs, but of course these are subject to commercial confidentiality. The problem with the share price has come off, because it's this typical sort of development issue where they find themselves in these protracted negotiations that eat into time, eat into capital. They had to change their business model last year to centre on a licensing or a fee-based model, rather than a company coming in and buying their technology outright. To begin with.
But that's a good model. I mean, that's yeah. why I say Arm operated and built up a huge business.
Exactly. Doing. I mean, the last thing, you're going to have a far more receptive audience if you say, well, you know, you're just paying sort of fee income, royalty income, if you like, on this, rather than some, you know, enormous, great big capital outlay up front. The trouble is that they're pretty much where they were 6 months ago, a year ago. And the money's running out, so they're going to have to tap the market by the end of this year, I think, or early into next year, looking at the figures.
I'm going to say, I'm looking at that, net cash, $25 million, pre-tax loss last year, $32 million. So yeah. Big cash outflows there.
I mean, the point with them is, it's I wouldn't say it's exactly a binary bet, but you are the blue sky element is will this be adopted wide scale, but the addressable market is absolutely huge, because you're looking at not just commercial laundries, but you're also looking at hotel groups.
Well, they use commercial laundries.
Well, they do, but some have in-house switches as well, in which case that technology would be ideal too. And the cost savings to these businesses is potentially huge. You can really see a compelling commercial case.
Put them in touch with Premier Inns.
Exactly that.
You do wonder why, you know, if this technology is so wonderful, it's not happening as quickly as you know, perhaps investors had previously expected. Hey, we've got them on a buy. It's blue sky.
It is blue sky, but you can expect there's going to be some further dilution of capital.
Now, another company that you wrote about this week that again, hasn't made the AIM-100, but is doing a bit better. There's profits there. But we shifted them to a sell, and that's profit taking.
It is just profit taking. In fact, there was a comment.
Coward.
There was a comment on the website lambasting me for this as well. my general coward. It wouldn't be the first time, but I hope it, taken in context with the copy itself, our valued reader will understand. I mean, it's been a.
Was it AB Dynamics?
Yeah, and it's up 51% in just a few months since our tip. So, I mean, you know, sometimes it's leave something for the other guys.
Run your winners, Robert.
Well,
you never made a loss by taking a profit.
Ooh. Quite so. You see how difficult
those,
it is?
Those market wisdom things. Which ones do you believe?
I hope I made it very clear in the text anyway that this is a quality British company, well-managed. It's well financed as well. It's in a sweet spot within the automotive industry. Even as new car registrations drop off a cliff in the United Kingdom, it's made money this year, and its sales are up in the domestic market. It's got huge sales growth in the rest of the world, which includes the China automotive market, which is now the world's largest and growing.
But it's not necessarily dependent upon new car sales. It's R&D, isn't it?
Yeah, it's R&D. And there's very, I mean. new car sales would obviously help, but it's to do more with the changes, the structural changes underway within the automotive industry.
And you would think that there is a lot of that taking place. You're hearing about, you know, your new electric vehicle ranges and the phasing out of petrol drive trains and that sort of thing.
Well, even more prosaic examples as well. The switch, the fastest growing segment of the automotive market is the development of SUVs. And every major automotive company is developing SUVs at the moment. And for each new model comes new testing opportunities. This technology is established. It's the industry standard in many respects as well. So for every new development, whether that's to do with drivetrains, automotive, or in fact just a change in modelling, as we're seeing with the development of SUVs, it's wholly positive for AB Dynamics. I mean, I've got no doubt, you know, there'll be some market weakness as there normally is, and we'll just take another look at them as well, because it's a really quality company. It's the sort of thing that we should be pushing.
When you say SUVs, you mean sports utility vehicles?
Yes, yes.
I mean, they've been around for a while, what's happening there specifically?
They've just become all the more popular. I mean, it was a case that used to be associated with off-road vehicles, but now, you know, you just look at the school run every morning, and you'll see Porsche SUVs, Jaguar SUVs.
Oh, it's a premium SUVs.
There's at the premium end, but also, it's a Nissan's best-selling vehicle is the...
Qashqai.
Yes.
Yeah, we got one.
And you only have to walk across any high road.
No, you're absolutely right. It feels like in that respect, we've got a touch of the Ricardos about this company, which I kind of like. You know, a support services company for the automotive industry. Ricardo's been around for over 100 years.
Yeah, but let's not forget as well that AB has got there's a regulatory element there as well, because some of the developments of Ricardo is what you could put down to a discretionary element within motor manufacturers. They can't get around safety issues. Mm. You know, that's the one thing they can't skirt around. And sort of increased regulatory strictures on that front, not just relating to safety as well, but also to do with emission standards too.
You're really selling this company to me, Robert. I think of this incongruous recommendation you had.
Well, it seems incongruous, but I mean, it just seemed like, you know, such a good opportunity as well to take some profits. As I say, we visit it, and I hope I've made it clear within the text that my real thoughts on the company.
Yeah, okay. Let's move to the actual AIM 100. And this week we're looking at the top 50. And you've written quite a few of them.
A few, yeah.
Yeah, we've got lots of stars on the magazine. Lots of people have contributed to this. But you have contributed a significant proportion. But we're going to focus on a couple of a little subsector that we've kind of spotted here within the AIM 100, which I think is particularly interesting. And that is games development. And we've got two companies in the AIM 100 that are involved in games development. And also a company in the results section that's quite new.
Yes, so Sumo Group is the company that was not in the AIM 100, but we did write the results up on this week.
I've never heard of them until this week.
Well, they only listed on AIM in December.
This
was their first set of results. And I suppose in that sense, the results are a little complicated. They were previously owned by a private equity fund. And so the results kind of reflect this pre-flotation leverage structure. But they do tell an interesting story. I mean, just to quickly say that the other two companies that we looked at within the AIM 100 are Frontier Developments, which produces video games, and also Keyword Studios, which provides services to the video games industry. So things like localization, language translation, and player support, among lots of other things. So Sumo Group, as I said, interesting but complicated results. Sumo said in its results that the video games industry was estimated to be worth around $113 billion in 2017.
Huge.
And that's about, I guess, 80 billion in pounds. And that industry is growing at a compound annual growth rate of around 8% to 2021. So huge, but not growing enormously every year. By comparison, Sumo obviously looks like a relatively small player. So its sales last year were around £31 million. But that represented a 27% year-on-year improvement. So it is thankfully growing faster than the wider industry.
Quite a substantial company. I mean, that is quite substantial still. What does it actually do then?
So it works with computer games publishers and developers like Microsoft, Sony, Warner Brothers, and I think Marvel is another one of them. And it basically helps these companies to produce their games, to develop, produce, and provide other services. In a way, other services similar to Keywords, and then it provides kind of creative services. And last year it bought a visual design company called Atom Hawk.
Okay.
Which I guess, yes, does what it says on the tin, provides visual design. But having said that, although I think typically it produces games with and for other companies, last year it created its first own intellectual property game called Snake Pass. I can't say I've tried that game, but it was obviously popular because it generated, I think, 1.7 million in sales for the company.
Yeah. I have no idea.
I still,
the only game I ever play is Mario Kart.
Yeah, well.
On a machine that's about 10 years old.
I think they don't believe that their own IP games will make up a huge amount of revenue going forwards, but it is, I think they said it was a sort of nice creative outlet for their stuff.
Shop window, maybe, for some of what they can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Go and have a look at that.
It's interesting. And I think we'll need to wait until we've seen sort of a longer period trading as a public company. At the moment, we kept them on a hold. I think they were trading on quite a high forward PE of around 23, I want to say. So
it's not
hugely
expensive.
High, especially in relation to other tech companies and other video games companies. But I think given that this is the first time we've covered them, we wanted to stay neutral until we'd sort of seen more results.
Yeah, okay, so wait and see.
Yeah, exactly.
And it looks like, I mean, given that, I mean, I don't think that's a particularly punchy valuation for a tech company in this space.
No.
I guess the market's taken a wait-and-see approach as well.
I mean, I should add, again, this is to do with the IPO partly, but their pre-tax losses did widen very considerably from, I think, 2.1 million to 28 million.
Yeah.
IPO that plus. Might not be a particularly appealing entry point.
But it's going to make a profit next year. On an underlying basis. So
yes, on an underlying basis.
I think it's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
How does it stack up in that respect against Keywords, which, as we've talked about, it provides a similar kind of service?
Well, Keywords is more of a sort of outsourcer. It provides outsourced services to video games companies.
It is similar in a way.
Keywords is obviously also a lot bigger. So its sales last year reached 151 million euros. Or around 130 million pounds. That represents a huge compound annual growth rate of 75% from 2013.
A lot of this is bought in growth.
Yes, so it has seen good organic growth, but it did make 11 new acquisitions last year. But it has been quite astute in its acquisitions. I think it made two of its largest ones last year. I think they were called VMC and Sparrowsoft. And those respectively enhanced its US presence and its Eastern European presence. I can't say I know what the Eastern European video games market is.
I don't think it's the market. I think it's where you get a lot of the skills base.
Yeah.
I'm going back a very long way now, but I do remember covering a number of video games companies whilst writing for the IC.
IDOS,
SCI Entertainment, and a lot of their production studios were out in Eastern Europe because you had very capable technical people, but it was much lower cost.
Interesting. I suppose it also helps that, their global presence is particularly important because they are doing language translation and localization. And a lot of these video games, some of the companies they work with include Activision, Blizzard and Sony. They've worked on titles like Call of Duty and Assassin's Creed. And
huge
they want to translate those games into as many languages and countries as possible. They need that kind of expansive presence.
Absolutely. Expensive shares, though.
As I say,
in the context of Sumo on 23, these look a bit more punchy valuation.
They are, and we do have Keywords on a buy, and that's, A, we've sort of covered them for a longer time, but B, we like the fact the gaming market is obviously it's set to keep growing. There's this increasing trend we can see towards games companies outsourcing to the likes of Keywords, and that does seem to be evident in what Sumo is doing as well. But I think for now, our confidence is with Keywords.
Yeah, I think it makes sense, the outsourcing thing. I think, we talked about outsourcers earlier, but in this industry, it makes a lot of sense. And we mentioned IDOS. I remember the problem they had, and IDOS essentially went bust.
Yeah.
The problem they had was all of their development was in-house. And it made it really hard for them to exert pressure on their development supply chain because it was internal. And
right.
So you've got these huge delays to games.
Yeah, really long lead times.
Huge lead times, but they couldn't. They were slipping in the case of IDOS because they basically couldn't. They couldn't, change it. They couldn't, exert a financial penalty on a supplier because it was themselves. Outsourcing has been a big. This move has been happening for a long time.
Yeah. And
although I haven't looked at it for a long time. So.
Well, luckily that looks set to continue, which is good news for Keywords and potentially Sumo.
Let's talk about Frontier, because this is a company that's actually making games.
It is,
or
yeah.
rather publishing games.
Publishing games, exactly. And Frontier was one of the top performing companies on the London markets in 2017. It just to kind of give a snapshot of what it did, it launched its second video game. It kind of committed to a third, which is Jurassic World. And it received a major investment from the big Chinese tech giant Tencent. I think at the time that we wrote on Frontier Developments for the AIM100, shares had risen more than 300% over the year. So it's obviously huge. We think we're probably not likely to see the same level of growth this year, because pre-tax profits are going to be dented by the necessary marketing spend on the new game. But longer term, we do like Frontier. We're actually really confident about this entire emerging sector on AIM. Peel Hunt reckons Jurassic World should lift revenues to about 66 million.
It's a big franchise. It's a big movie franchise.
Yeah. And it will hopefully massively lift revenues in 2019, almost doubling them, I think, from 37 million last year to 66 million.
Yeah,
forecast.
I wrote an editorial on this because I thought the share price was rising and they'd had this huge hit. I think it was a game called Elite.
Yes, yeah.
Which was kind of a remake of something that
was about
I bet you remember Elite,
Robert. About Oxford?
No, it wasn't. Elite was one of the really early kind of space exploration games.
Mm.
They got vector graphics. I mean, it's literally lines on a screen, and everyone loved it. And they've updated it, and it's huge.
Yeah,
it's,
well, I suppose Jurassic World is obviously this ongoing franchise, but it is based on the original, in a way, Jurassic Park. So it's nice to see that these movies are being recycled and used in video games.
That's it. I suspect that's about a big license for that. So that's the kind of thing that worries me slightly about these kind of things.
Yeah.
The licensing costs can be huge.
Well, that's the issue. I think, the costs of launching these games are very high, and also they can be unpredictable. So we actually...
Well, it also depends if the game's any good.
Exactly. They rely on this. I guess it's a little bit like... It's like a film. I mean, often these games are based on films, but, you are really relying on them being a hit, and if they're not... then it can be detrimental. So we had them on a hold just because I think the EV to adjusted cash profit ratio was 19 when we wrote on it, which is obviously pretty steep, especially given the investment required for game launches. But I think, again, watch this space. We do like Frontier Developments. It's just expensive.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's always been a great industry in the UK, the games industry.
Yeah.
And it's good to see them coming back to the market. Let's hope they do well. But yeah, it makes me nervous, that one. Even though I'm sure it's a great company. Just that price.
Yeah, it's expensive.
It's expensive. Definitely. All right. Well, thank you, Harriet. There are so many more companies in here. I mean, I know it's Blue Prism was another one you've written, which is really interesting. But
back office automation doesn't sound interesting, but actually is.
Well, it's robots, isn't it?
Yeah,
don't say back office automation, say robots.
Robots, I think, yeah. They call it a sort of digital workforce. Yeah, it is interesting. And also learning technologies.
God, we didn't even talk about that, which we had to change halfway through because there was a big acquisition this week.
Yes, so learning technologies is one of our longer reads in the AIM100 this week. And on Tuesday, just after market close, they announced their biggest ever acquisition. So Learning Technologies has historically been an acquisitive company. It's a portfolio company made up of lots of corporate learning businesses. But it announced that it had bought People. It was going to buy PeopleFluent, which is a cloud-based talent management platform, for $150 million, which is around £107 million. Funded via a share placing to raise around $80 million. In the end, they raised $85 million by the following morning. And also incremental debt financing. It's a big deal for them, and very exciting.
Yeah, big companies like us like these sort of these products. So
you can see it's another bite up of ours, actually.
Okay, well let's keep an eye on that one. Thank you very much. Loads more in the AIM100. Some of the really biggest companies are named this week. In fact, all the biggest companies are named, but companies are so big that they would make it into the FTSE 100. So you've got ASOS, you've got Fevertree Drinks. Who doesn't like a gin and tonic? That was one of yours, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes.
You were really positive on that at the beginning, and I was sceptical.
I was very positive at the beginning, but I think it was another instance where I might have just got out a little bit too early. I took my G&T and scarpered.
Yeah, it's down the pub with your G&T. It's I think these Fevertree shares are too expensive.
But how do you compare like with like? There's no fixed assets. There's just it's extraordinary story. Really.
It is an extraordinary story, and I mean, I think we've got it on hold, but you know, you could just see this going. I think your pitch was that it was going to be a takeover target.
I thought so, and by the obvious offeror as well. But no, I think they're going to milk it for all it's worth.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. The new Schweppes,
indeed,
just wow. With nice,
Schweppes.
Nice. Huh?
Poor Schweppes.
Poor Schweppes. anyway, thank you very much. Thank you, Harriet. Thank you.
Just on that point, actually, they never actually ate into that marketplace of Schweppes. They created a new marketplace altogether, linking in with the sort of premium gin brands. Mm. Interesting point. You know, they've created value.
Oh, like it's the old craft beer thing as well.
Yes.
I think Stuart Lee did a wonderful sketch about craft beer.
Yes.
So basically,
you pitch people like you and I,
and you convince them they're not alcoholics by suggesting there's some cultural merit in drinking.
Getting drunk
stuff.
In front of the TV.
Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you all for listening. There is loads in the magazine beyond the A100. Actually, quite a busy results section with a few interesting things in there. Lots in the news section.
Digital banking as well on the sector focus.
Emma
will be following that up next week with a review of the banking Q1s.
Yes, that's true. Lead story in the news section is oil and gas, looking at some of the companies that have benefited from the strong price there, and we're following that up too.
Alex will be looking at both Shell and BP in the next issue of the magazine as well.
Yeah, lots going on in oil.
Yes.
I didn't realise, when I was on holiday, I was literally staying around the corner from OPEC. I'd forgotten it was in Vienna.
Oh,
I should
of course,
have got some
Vienna,
photos.
Yes, like, yeah. So. What's that? Is that every 2 years? I can't remember if it's... they trot along there every 2 years?
I don't know.
Or maybe it's twice a year. I can't remember.
There you go.
I used to cover the sector as
funny
well.
Funny place for OPEC to be. I guess it's kind of neutral, isn't it? Austria, I don't think, is a big oil producer.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway, enough. We're bumping up against the clock. Thank you all for listening. The A100 Part 2, Beautiful Butterfly, as we told you last week,
it's
would be the case. It's a what?
An admiral, I think.
I'm not sure it is, but I think it's just generic butterfly. But thank you very much for listening. Pick up the magazine, all good news agents, £4.90, or get on the website and subscribe. Thank you very much.